This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hey, you. Yeah, you, in the cafe. Did you know that over half of the people who listen to Joy are allies of the LGBTIQ+ community, just like you? So you may not be aware, but times are very tough financially at Joy, and we're reaching out for your support. Tell your next-door neighbour, your friends, and even your dad to head over to joy.org.au and help us build Joy Nation by making a donation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
This is Saturday Magazine.
You are on Sat Mag. You're with Mark and Warren this morning. Macca and Tass are attending a wedding this morning, which is very exciting for them. And it's allowed us to get loose in the Joy Studios together. And we can, you know, run them up today, can't we?
Yeah.
That took you a few seconds. Hey, we were talking earlier, Mark, about valuing ourselves. And Betty has texted in saying, well said, valuing ourselves is important. Got another message here as well. Good morning, Sat Mag. I'm loving the passion and enthusiasm of both of you. Refreshing from Macca. Tongue planted in cheek, of course. Thanks for that feedback. Hey, we are going to be chatting very, very shortly to Misha Ketchall, who is the editor of The Conversation. I love The Conversation.
Yeah, it's great. The fact that it's not written from a particular view to sell eyeballs and earballs. Mm-hmm. It's about people who are subject matter experts, academics, people who are authoritative on the subject, and they're sharing their information rather than trying to get clicks.
Yes.
Is a big differentiator between so many other media outlets at the moment. And we've got Misha here at the moment, and Misha can talk to us more about The Conversation and give the listeners, and I know you come on regularly, just give people the nutshell about The Conversation that's better than mine.
Well, first of all, good morning.
Good morning, Misha.
It's nice to see you. It's nice to be here in the Pride Centre. And I love the idea of earballs. I'm not quite sure.
Earballs.
I'm not quite sure I've heard of earballs before, but I love the idea of not being about monetizing earballs. Just to explain The Conversation really quickly, the sort of the idea behind it is that in the media currently, we have some problems with misinformation and disinformation. And also, I mean, there's another problem going on, which former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd talks about, which is concentration of media ownership. And one of the things that people really need is quality information that they can trust. And so The Conversation works just with academics, only with academics who are experts in their field, most of the time to explain and inform the public. So the public's got information they can really rely upon. Things like, you know, whether you need a fourth vaccine for COVID-19 or the latest health expertise on, you know, how to avoid skin cancer, political analysis, arts, culture, science. It sort of spans across everything. But the idea is that in the media currently, almost all the information that you get comes via a vested interest, whether it be a commercial interest, a politician that's got something they want to sell so they can get re-elected, an advertiser. Everything actually almost always has an ulterior motive. And the idea of The Conversation, as you were so generously saying in introducing me, is trying to provide information without an ulterior motive. Yeah.
How have you found that received? Are you finding people relying on it? Can you tell on your click traffic?
Yes, it's been an astonishing success. So The Conversation was launched in Melbourne in 2011. And now it's operating globally. There's teams in the US, UK, France, Africa, Spain, Canada, Indonesia. And it gets, I think, something around about 20 million page views a month, which is very, very large. Its Australian audience, I think, is about 7 million, which, you know, sort of puts it up there in sort of the top 20 media outlets in Australia in terms of digital traffic. So it's actually growing really quickly. Probably doesn't have quite the brand recognition of some of the other more established media outlets, but its audience is very big.
One thing that I do love about The Conversation is, academics can have a reputation of not being able to necessarily communicate at a level that everyone else can understand because they're so used to being experts in their field and talking about their expertise so often. And the thing that I do love about The Conversation is it allows them to to write articles and express themselves that is easily understood by everyone. And I think that is fantastic, and it's a great skill that academics have.
Well, thank you. That's a little bit of, I guess, the work we do, sort of behind the curtain. There's a little bit of sort of massaging of copy sometimes.
I noticed you smiling when I was saying that.
Yeah. Look, I mean, you know, to be honest, there's a wide range of skills. Some academics are really terrific and very talented public communicators. Others actually need a little bit of help. But the truth is, we don't mind doing that because that's what we're there for. And if they've got something substantive and interesting to say, the actual job of massaging the copy, you know, making it really sort of tightly written, is not that challenging. It's really got to do with the quality of the ideas. If the ideas are good, translating them isn't hard.
So you've got to battle some very emotive issues that have been politicised in a way to get people into power, something like refugees.
Yes.
So let's talk about that at the moment. There's been a lot of change this week. And what's the view from the conversation?
Well, it's interesting. The government did a deal this week with New Zealand to resettle 450 refugees, asylum seekers, over the course of 3 years. And it was a deal that was offered to the government, or I think when the New Zealand government came forward and offered something, I think as far back as 2013, so quite some time ago. It's only just happening now. And I think although everybody who works in the refugee space is really pleased that this has happened, there is a little bit of cynicism about the timing, just that it feels like it's sort of a process of clearing the decks before an election. And given the long periods of time, many of these people have been incarcerated, you know, some of them 6, 7, 8 years or more. I think there's still a real feeling that there's sort of a, you know, I guess a stain on our reputation in terms of the way that we've handled that. So there's some criticism, but also it's a good development.
Well, there's some valid criticism. There's also a lot of chatter about Senator Lambie and a comment about going to jail about a piece of paper. Do you have insight on that? Because it seems like it's a sticking point that's not well clarified.
Yes. Now, look, I'm perhaps not as well versed in this as you might be, so I'll just tell you the bits that I know, and perhaps you can help me fill in the gaps here. But my understanding is this has got to do with a sort of a threat that was made to her. Was it via the Prime Minister's office?
Allegedly.
But, you know, but according to her allegation, that if she revealed the terms of a deal, which had to do with the Medivac, that, you know, she would be in breach of, you know, a confidentiality requirement and could face sort of criminal consequences. And I guess that's been revealed this week in the context sort of a claim about sort of, you know, perhaps improper, you know, use of power or bullying, or that was sort of how she framed it. But that's sort of all I know about that bit, so perhaps you can tell me more about that.
But I don't think, I think that's part of the distraction around the politics of refugees. We've got real humans who are in real crisis, who come to us as a safe haven, and this is how we are treated by the people who are making the decision. We are treated as people who have to be a part of a politicised process rather than the empathetic nation that we were for so long in so many ways. Not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but this is such a stain on us.
That's right. And I think it actually goes to another important point, which is the way in which the game of politics gets in the way of the substance of it. So, you know, part of the criticism, and perhaps the reason the Lambie criticism is to some extent hitting home, is because there's a general criticism around the Morrison government that everything that they do is around the spin, the media management, the sort of getting re-elected. But generally speaking, the point of that should be that underneath it, there's something that you want to achieve for the country, that there's an agenda, there's sort of policy ideas. And if you're allowing that sort of political combat, I want this to be portrayed in a certain way, to distort the outcomes you're delivering, then that sort of is a problem. And I think that the feeling is that perhaps the spin and the management of the way that this would play in the electorate was placed above actually the outcomes and the human beings involved. And that's obviously disappointing.
And we've seen also, like, this government has been so harsh, as you rightly point out, on refugees. And we've seen now this backflip on a policy that was, or a deal that was originally negotiated in, what was it, 2013 under Gillard.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was negotiated. The New Zealand deal was offered, but I don't think it was actually negotiated at that point.
Okay, offered. Yeah. And then we've also seen, say, the funding restored to the ABC as well. I mean, to me, that smacks of sort of desperation of a government that sense smells a bit of trouble at the election.
I think so. And actually, it's interesting because one of the other things that The Conversation published this week, Michelle Grattan's doing a special project in the electorate of Wentworth, Malcolm Turnbull's former electorate. And, you know, there's sort of an independent candidate, Allegra Spender, who is going up against Dave Sharma, who's sort of a, I guess what you could call a moderate liberal.
Teal Dave.
Yes. And
it's a teal. Yes, that's right.
He's gone teal. He's a chameleon. He's changed colours. Isn't that interesting? I wonder why.
And it was interesting because we've done some polling and some work in that electorate. And it looks like, in that electorate in particular, now that's just one electorate, but it does look like Scott Morrison is actually quite unpopular. Albanese, at the moment, that electorate is preferred PM. And it looks like, you know, Dave Sharma is just slightly ahead, but he's under pressure from Allegra Spender. So you're sort of starting to see some of that, I think, that there is pressure on the coalition now.
Can that be extrapolated to other independent seats, like Kooyong, for example, with Josh Frydenberg, where we've also got the Teal Brigade challenging that seat as well?
I think that there is, you know, everybody talks about this sort of, you know, the Teal Brigade and these independents across the country. And, I mean, yes, it's... I'm not a cephologist, so I'm not an expert on the actual polling numbers in those seats. And there are, you know, each seat is individual. They're very specific, so there's real questions about who actually has a real chance and who doesn't. And I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't be qualified to comment on whether, you know, the independent in Josh Frydenberg's seat has a strong prospect of winning. But I think that there is a real move to those independents, and that is also born, I think, of a frustration, you know, with the current sort of political process.
You're on Sat Mag with Mark and Warren this morning, and we're joined by Misha Keshel from The Conversation, the editor of The Conversation. And Macca and Tass, of course, are attending a wedding, and we did get a message in saying that Macca is listening. So it's
this rather foreboding.
So it's made us all very, very, very
best behaviour.
Yeah. Now, Michelle, can I just ask you? We've had Facebook and Google refusing to pay for some of their work under the News Media Bargaining Code. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So the News Media Bargaining Code was a law, a very actually innovative law created by ACCC Chair Rod Sims, and the idea was that digital media giants are making a lot of money out of journalism. Journalism is really important democratically. It's a public good, and that we should support it and encourage it. And so the idea was that that basically Facebook and Google, as two particular companies under this law, would have to do deals with and pay media outlets for using their content. And a lot of deals have been done. Millions of dollars have gone to 7, 9, News Corp, major publishers. But the way the law works is... the publishers can decide who to negotiate with and who not to negotiate with unless they're designated by the treasurer. And Facebook in particular has refused to negotiate with a lot of media companies, including The Conversation. So I've got an interest in this, SBS, and also a lot of medium and smaller publishers who are producing public interest journalism. Now, the problem with that...
So there's an amount of money, right? 75,000, is that?
Sorry?
Isn't that a cash threshold of earnings?
No. There's...
Oh, that's a recommendation. Sorry.
Yeah. So basically, they've done a deal with a lot of big publishers. They've actually shut out a lot of small and medium publishers. Now, the problem with that is we're in a country where there's really poor media diversity already. We have really concentrated media ownership. And if you're saying that journalism is a public good and you want to support it, part of what you want to do is you want to support diversity. You want to support joy. You want to support The Conversation. You want to support, you know, broadsheet. You want to support a whole range of publications, not just existing players. So, in effect, the perverse outcome of this law, which was to support journalism, is actually it's giving a competitive advantage to the bigger companies versus the smaller companies, because they're getting all this money that the smaller companies aren't getting.
Do you think that was intended in the drafting of the legislation?
No, it's an unintended consequence. And basically what happened was this week, all of the smaller and medium publishers got together and had a protest where they didn't put news up on their site. I think it was Tuesday this week. And basically what they're doing is calling for the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, to designate. So to basically say to Facebook and Google, you've got to negotiate with everybody, not just a select few. Because what happens otherwise is a whole bunch of money gets directed to a range of media outlets that then benefit from that money in the lead up to an election. And some of the diverse media voices don't get the same advantage.
Misha, do we know what are the younger generations, where they're consuming their news from? Because my concern is if they're not necessarily going to some of the bigger organisations like the News Corps and the ABCs, etc., that therefore if the Google and Facebook aren't funding the smaller organisations, the younger generation are essentially going to be missing out on quality journalism.
Look, I think that's true, because one of the things that you see in media is fragmentation. I mean, it used to be, you know, I guess in the old days, you know, there was an extent to which everybody was reading, say, newspapers before radio came along, mm-hmm. and everyone then would say was listening to regular radio and, you know, regular TV shows. All of that sort of appointment radio has sort of changed. Those markets have really changed. You look at, say, television markets, they're really skewing much older now. Younger people are increasingly getting their content digitally. One of the things that we're doing at The Conversation is actually not seeing our product as just articles that we publish, but seeing our product as Instagram posts or, you know, Facebook posts or things that we put on Twitter, because we know that there are young audiences that are getting no news anywhere else and they need quality information, because otherwise what they're getting is QAnon and, you know, a whole bunch of misinformation. So
that corrupting influence, do you think that a federal ICAC has a role to play in correcting that imbalance of disinformation that people are receiving across the board, or do you think that that would be a damn squib?
I think, I guess just moving on to ICAC, it's a somewhat different issue, because we're talking about like sort of media regulation when it comes to the News Media Bargaining Code. With the ICAC, it's sort of interesting. The Coalition promised to bring in an ICAC and then didn't. They had a draft proposal that was widely criticised by experts. It was criticised for a few reasons. It sort of divided the anti-corruption body into looking at police and looking at politicians. And when it came to police, anybody could make a complaint. The processes were open. When it came to politicians, you could only make a complaint if it was a criminal matter. You had to make it to another authority first, which basically made it really limited its power to oversee politicians. And, you know, given the sorts of things that we've seen, say, in recent times, so sports rorts, car park rorts, what's been happening with, you know, Bernard Collaery and East Timor and a whole range of things that governments have done, there is a real perception that you need an independent body to scrutinise them and that the government's failed. I actually did an interview this week with Helen Haynes, who's the independent member for INDI, and Stephen Charles, who is a former appeal court judge, who is a very strong advocate of a model for an independent anti-corruption commission. And basically, the argument that they're putting is that the health of our democracy, our democratic functioning, needs sort of a cop on the beat for the federal politicians, and we just don't have it.
Misha, in the Sydney Morning Herald last year, they were saying that more than two-thirds of Australians support the creation of a powerful federal anti-corruption watchdog. I'm surprised that the federal government doesn't take note of these statistics, and they must have a really strong level of resistance towards implementing one if their constituents want one as well.
They do, and look, I mean, to some extent, I don't want to cut them too much slack, but I do think that there is an argument, right? And the argument goes like this. To some extent, say take pork barrelling. It's an exercise of ministerial discretion. Now, we've seen pretty clear and flagrant use of government money to buy votes, which is a form of corruption. And I think people have been very clearly critical of that. But it's only a few degrees along the spectrum, and you're actually looking at a legitimate exercise of ministerial discretion to decide where resources go. And there is a role in our democracy for ministers to make decisions. And to some extent, they might say, well, look, I'm making the decisions about where the money's going to go. If you don't like it, you can vote me out. But the democratic process is that as a minister, that's part of my role. If you put in an ICAC, the criticism or the fear is that it could be used politically to attack politicians in a way that may be unfair, might unfairly malign them or affect their reputations, and sort of creates a separate source of power or scrutiny to the democratic process. And I think some politicians are uneasy about that. They feel like it's not proper, or it's an encroachment on their rightfully won political power. Now, I mean, I think I don't agree with that argument. I think that ultimately, in any part of life, you have rules, and those rules help set the culture. And you can definitely see that there has been a for want of a better word, coarsening or corruption of the political culture, sort of anything goes sort of mentality. And I think everybody would be much happier if there was a cop on the beat. But there is some argument around how you structure that and how you think about it.
And also, I mean, a level of transparency as well as to how decisions are made. But surely they can put in checks and balances into an ICAC process so that, you know, if politicians did feel that they were just being attacked for the sake of it, these would highlight those.
That's right. And I think, you know, one of the things that has been criticised about the version that Helen Haynes has put up is retrospectivity, for example. And Helen Haynes argues that having an ICAC that can respectively look at old things is a useful part of weeding out corruption. But
What did she say about that specifically? Because it's a really interesting thing. Normally law doesn't look retrospectively. That's part of the doctrine of moving forwards. What is she saying? What did you capture from your conversation with her?
Well, there's no there's no plan to introduce retrospective law. So basically, you have only committed a crime or done something wrong if you're breaching the law as it stood at the time. So retrospectivity is not about changing the law retrospectively. It's about giving the ICAC a chance to investigate whether previous conduct was a breach of the law as it stood at that time. And the reason for that, or the argument that that's necessary, is because it goes to questions of pattern and questions of areas where there might need to be work. Like, basically, for the commission to be able to do its job effectively, it needs to be able to do some of that. I think that's still an area where there could be some debate and some compromise, because I do think that you can get that thing where it seems like, say, for example, there were a change of government at this election, and certainly Labor has promised to set up a federal ICAC, and then the federal ICAC was set up and its whole role was investigating the previous government, it can start to look a bit witch-hunty. So I do think you've got to think about how you structure that.
What was wrong with the New South Wales model? Because I know Scott Morrison was adamant that that model wasn't going to be implemented. Was it simply because of Gladys Berejiklian and it was seen to be targeting her in an unfair process?
Yeah, and there was, I mean, not just Gladys Berejiklian, Barry O'Farrell as well, the bottle of wine. For Stephen Charles, for example, his argument is that Barry O'Farrell made a mistake resigning. He could have easily just come back and said, because he sort of perjured himself effectively about the bottle of wine, he could have easily come back and said, look, I made a mistake, I forgot, I'm just going to correct the record, I apologise sincerely, and that potentially would have been fine. But he made the choice to resign, which perhaps wasn't appropriate. But this is the fear, right? This is where the politicians do feel like there is a risk that small matters can be blown up, their reputations can be traduced in a very public way when there is less substance. And, I mean, the Gladys Berejiklian one is interesting because certainly, you know, there was a clear matter to be investigated and there was a proper process. But Scott Morrison's argument is that, you know, he feels that she was sort of unfairly handed out of office. Now, I don't think that the evidence bears that up. I think people were very critical of his comments, but it does go to the fear. It tells you what politicians are afraid of.
Misha, we've got a question in saying, can you ask Misha about the ongoing factional war in the ALP and the senator's death? Some media are still running with this mean girls narrative. Why so biased?
That's a terrific question. And there's been some great work in Crikey writing about this. There's a writer there called Guy Rundle who's written about a lot on this issue. And basically he said that the media has actually failed to dig down into the narrative. There was a big factional war going on. Kimberley Kitchen was a very smart factional fighter, and the right faction that she was a part of was losing power. She'd lost her role on the tactics committee. This attempt to cast it as mean girls is misleading, and basically a lot of journalists don't really understand in depth what's going on within the factions. It is very complicated and very hard to tell that story. So what we've got is sort of a glib story, which is about mean girls, which isn't really true, basically, I think.
John also says, why does the Labor Party continuously kick own goals when it comes to election time?
We've only got two hours, John.
Yes. I don't know. I mean, politics is really tricky. I guess one of the things that happens is the jostling about who gets Senate spots, pre-selections, that it'll happen in the lead-up. So, you know, it can sort of spill over into the period. And we're not far away. I mean, the election is expected to be announced. I mean, most people are predicting at the moment, not this Sunday, but next Sunday. So
it seems like it's never going to be announced.
Well, it's already happening, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Misha. Thank you so much for coming in and chatting with us today. It is Misha Ketchall, editor of The Conversation.
You've been listening to Saturday Magazine on Australia's first and only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.